Crusades through Arab Eyes by Alin Maalouf. Continued. Cassette 3, Side 1. Then, on a signal from their emir, they spun around, encircling their pursuers and cutting them to pieces. Bohemond and Tancred split away from the bulk of their troops and hid behind a hill, from which they hoped to assault the Muslims from behind. But when they saw that their troops were defeated, they decided to stay where they were. They waited there until nightfall and then fled, pursued by the Muslims, who killed and captured a good number of their companions. They themselves escaped, along with 6 knights. Among the Frankish chiefs participating in the Battle of Harran was Baldwin II, a cousin of the King of Jerusalem, who had succeeded him at the head of the county of Edessa. He, too, tried to flee, but his mount slipped in the mud while he was fording the Balik. The soldiers of Sokman took him prisoner and led him to the tent of their master. According to the account of Ibn al-Athir, this aroused the jealousy of their allies. Jekyll Mish's men said to him, "What will we look like if the others take all the booty and we sit here empty-handed?" And they persuaded him to seek out the count in Sokman's tent. When the latter returned, he seemed deeply moved. His companions were already in the saddle, preparing for battle, but he restrained them, saying, "The joy our victory has aroused among the Muslims must not be spoiled by our dispute. I do not want to soothe my anger by granting satisfaction to the enemy at the expense of the Muslims." He then assembled all the weapons and banners he had taken from the Frange, dressed his men in their clothing, ordered them to mount up, and then headed for the fortresses held by the Frange. It was their custom, whenever they saw their companions returning victorious, to rush out to meet them. They did so this time, too, and Sokman massacred them and seized the fortress. He repeated this stratagem in several places. The victory of Harran had profound repercussions, as Ibn al-Qalanisi's unusually enthusiastic tone testifies. "For the Muslims it was an unequal triumph. The morale of the Frange was deeply affected, their numbers were reduced, their offensive capacity undermined, and their arsenal depleted. The morale of the Muslims rose, their ardor in defense of their religion was enhanced. People congratulated one another on this victory, feeling certain that success had forsaken the Frange." One Frange, and not one of the less important either, was indeed demoralized by his defeat, and that was Bohemond. A few months later he sailed away, never again to set foot on Arab land. The Battle of Harran thus removed from the scene the invasion's principal architect, this time for good. More important, it halted the Frange drive to the east forever. The victors, however, like the Egyptians in 1102, proved unable to reap the fruit of their success. Instead of advancing together against Edessa, only 2 days' march from the battlefield, they separated in a fresh outbreak of their dispute. Although Sokman's trick had enabled him to seize a few relatively unimportant fortresses, Jekermish was soon taken by surprise by Tancred, who managed to capture several leading members of his entourage. Among them was a young princess of rare beauty. The ruler of Mosul was so enamored of her that he sent word to Bohemond and Tancred that he was prepared either to exchange her for Baldwin II of Edessa or to buy her back for 15,000 gold dinars. Uncle and nephew consulted and then informed Jekermish that on balance they preferred to take the money and to leave their companion in captivity, where he remained for another 3 years. It is not known how the emir felt about this less than chivalrous response from the Frankish chiefs. He nevertheless paid them the agreed sum, recovered his princess, and kept Baldwin. But the affair was not over yet. Indeed, it was ultimately to give rise to one of the most curious episodes of the Frankish Wars. The scene occurred 4 years later, at the beginning of October 1108, in a field of plum trees where the last of the dark fruit was ripening. The surrounding lightly wooded hills seemed to stretch out endlessly. On one of them rose the majestic ramparts of Tel Bashir, alongside which the two opposing armies offered an unusual spectacle. In one camp stood Tancred of Antioch, ringed by 1,500 Frankish knights and foot soldiers, wearing cavaliers that covered head and nose, firmly gripping their swords, maces, and sharpened battle-axe. Alongside them stood 600 long-haired Turkish cavalry, sent from Aleppo by Ridwan. In the other camp stood Jawali, the emir of Mosul, his coat of mail covered by a flowing robe with brocade sleeves. His army was composed of 2,000 men divided into 3 battalions, Arabs on the left, Turks on the right, and in the center, Frankish knights, among them Baldwin of Edessa and his cousin Drusilin, master of Tel Bashir. Could the participants in the titanic battle of Antioch possibly have believed that, a mere 10 years later, a governor of Mosul, successor of the Atabeg Karbuka, would make an alliance with a Frankish count of Edessa, and that the two would fight side by side against a coalition made up of a Frankish prince of Antioch and the Seljuk king of Aleppo? It had decidedly not taken the Frange long to become full partners in the murderous game of the Muslim petty kings. The chroniclers do not seem in the least astonished. The hint of an amused grin may just be detected in Ibn al-Athir, but he mentions the quarrels and alliances of the Frange without any change in tone. Just as he speaks, throughout his perfect history, of the innumerable conflicts among the Muslim princes. The Arab historian explains that while Baldwin was being held prisoner in Mosul, Tancred took Edessa, which suggests that he was not all that eager for his companion to recover his freedom. In fact, he had intrigued with Jekermish to have him held as long as possible. In 1107, however, this emir was overthrown, and the count now fell into the hands of the new master of Mosul, Jawali, a Turkish adventurer of remarkable intelligence, who immediately understood the advantage he could draw from the dispute between the two Frankish chiefs. He therefore freed Baldwin, offered him vestments of honor, and concluded an alliance with him. "Your Edessa fiefdom is threatened," he told him in substance, "and my position in Mosul is scarcely secure. Let us aid one another." As soon as he was released, Ibn al-Athir relates, Count Baldwin, Al-Komis Badawil, went to see Tancred in Antioch and asked him to restore Edessa to him. Tancred offered him 30,000 dinars, horses, arms, clothing, and many other things, but refused to restore the city to him. When Baldwin left Antioch in a fury, Tancred tried to follow him to prevent him from uniting with his ally Jawali. There were a number of clashes between them, but after each battle they came together again to eat and chat. These Frange are crazy, the Mosul historian seems to be saying. And he continues, since they had not succeeded in settling this problem, an attempt at mediation was made by the patriarch, who is a sort of imam for them. He appointed a commission of bishops and priests who testified that before returning to his home country, Bohemond, the uncle of Tancred, had advised Tancred to restore Edessa to Baldwin if he were released from captivity. The master of Antioch accepted this arbitration, and the count again took possession of his domain. Believing that his victory was due less to Tancred's goodwill than to his fear of intervention by Jawali, Baldwin quickly released all the Muslim prisoners in his territory, going so far as to execute one of his Christian functionaries who had publicly insulted Islam. Tancred was not the only leader exasperated by the curious alliance between the count and the emir. King Ridwan of Aleppo wrote to the master of Antioch to warn him against the ambitions and perfidy of Jawali. He told him that the emir coveted Aleppo, and that if he succeeded in taking it, the Frange would be unable to maintain their positions in Syria. The Seljuk king's concern for the security of the Frange seems somewhat ludicrous, but among princes, understanding is always possible, regardless of religious or cultural barriers. A new Islamo-Frankish coalition was therefore formed to counter the earlier one. Thus it was that in October 1108, these two armies stood opposite one another near the ramparts of Tel Bashir. The men of Antioch and Aleppo soon gained the advantage. Jawali fled, and a large number of Muslims sought refuge in Tel Bashir, where Baldwin and his cousin Drusilin treated them with kindness. They cared for the wounded, gave them clothing, and led them home. The Arab historian's tribute to Baldwin's chivalrous spirit stands in sharp contrast to the opinion the Christian inhabitants of Edessa had formed of the count. Upon learning that he had been defeated, and presumably believing him dead, the Armenians of the city thought that the time had come to rid themselves of Frankish domination. On his return, Baldwin found the city being administered by a kind of commune. Uneasy at his subjects' desire for independence, he had the principal notables arrested, among them several priests, and ordered their eyes put out. His ally Jawali would dearly have liked to take similar action against the notables of Mosul, who had likewise taken advantage of his absence to revolt. But he had to forego the urge, for his defeat had discredited him too thoroughly. His subsequent fate was unenviable. He lost his fief, his army, and his treasure, and the Sultan Mohammed put a price on his head. But Jawali did not admit defeat. He disguised himself as a merchant, traveled to the palace of Isfahan, and threw himself suddenly and humbly before the throne of the Sultan, holding his own shroud in his hands. Mohammed was touched and agreed to pardon him. Sometime later, he named him governor of a province in Persia. As for Tancred, his victory of 1108 brought him to the apogee of his glory. Principality of Antioch became a regional power feared by all its neighbors, be they Turk, Arab, Armenian, or Frank. King Ridwan was now no more than a cringing vassal. The nephew of Bohemond dubbed himself the Grand Emir. Just a few weeks after the Battle of Tel Bashir, which sanctioned the presence of the Frange in northern Syria, it was the turn of the Kingdom of Damascus to sign an armistice with Jerusalem. Under the terms of the agreement, the revenue from the agricultural land lying between the two capitals would be split in three. One-third for the Turks, one-third for the Frange, and one-third for the peasants, notes Ibn al-Qalanisi. A protocol was drafted on that basis. Several months later, the Syrian metropolis signed a new treaty acknowledging the loss of an even more important zone. The rich plain of Bekaa, east of the Lebanese mountains, was in turn divided with the Kingdom of Jerusalem. In fact, the Damascenes were reduced to impotence. Their harvests were at the mercy of the Frange, and their trade passed through the port of Acre, now ruled by Genoese merchants. In southern and northern Syria alike, the Frankish occupation was a daily reality. But the Frange did not stop there. In 1108, they stood on the eve of the most sweeping territorial expansion they had attempted since the fall of Jerusalem. All the great coastal cities were threatened, and the local potentates had neither the strength nor the will to defend them. The initial target was Tripoli. Saint-Gilles had camped on the outskirts of the city back in 1103 and had ordered the construction of a fortress which the citizens still knew by his name. The well-preserved Calhat Saint-Gilles is still visible in the 20th century, in the center of the modern city of Tripoli. At the time of the arrival of the Frange, however, the city extended no further than the Mina quarter, the port, which lay at the end of a peninsula access to which was controlled by this famous fortress. No caravan could reach or leave Tripoli without being intercepted by Saint-Gilles' men. The Qadi Far al-Mulk wanted at all costs to destroy this citadel, which threatened to strangle his capital. Night after night, his soldiers attempted daring raids, stabbing a guard or damaging a wall under construction. But it was in September 1104 that the most spectacular operation was mounted. The entire garrison of Tripoli effected a sortie en masse led by the Qadi himself. Several Frankish warriors were massacred, and a wing of the fortress was burned. Saint-Gilles himself was caught by surprise atop one of the flaming roofs. Suffering from severe burns, he died 5 months later in terrible agony. As he lay dying, he asked to see emissaries from Fakh al-Mulk and proposed a deal. The Tripolitanians would stop their assault on the citadel, and in exchange, the Frankish chief would promise never again to interfere with the flow of travelers and goods. The Qadi agreed. It was a strange compromise. Is not the aim of a siege precisely to prevent the circulation of people and foodstuff? And yet one has the impression that besiegers and besieged had established something approaching normal relations. The port of Tripoli suddenly enjoyed a spurt of activity, as caravans came and went after paying a tax to the Frange, and Tripolitanian notables crossed enemy lines with safe conduct passes. In fact, however, the belligerents were simply waiting each other out. The Frange anticipated the arrival of a Christian fleet from Genoa or Constantinople, which would enable them to assault the besieged city. The Tripolitanians, not unaware of this, were expecting a Muslim army to speed to their rescue. The most effective support should logically have come from Egypt, for the Fatimid Caliphate was a great maritime power whose intervention would suffice to discourage the Frange. But once again, relations between the lords of Tripoli and Cairo were disastrous. Al-Attal's father had been a slave in the Qadi's household, and it seems that he had been on very bad terms with his masters. The vizier had never concealed his rancor and his desire to humiliate Fakhr al-Mulk, who for his part would have preferred to abandon his city to Saint-Gilles rather than place his fate in the hands of Al-Abdal. The Qadi could rely on no ally in Syria either. He had to seek help elsewhere. When news of the Harran victory reached him in June 1104, he immediately dispatched a message to the Emir Sukman, begging him to complete his triumph by driving the French from Tripoli. He sweetened his request with a gift of a great quantity of gold and also promised to cover all the expedition's expenses. The victor of Harran was tempted. Assembling a powerful army, he set out for Syria. But when he was less than 4 days' march from Tripoli, he was halted by an attack of angina. His troops dispersed. The morale of the Cadi and his subjects collapsed. Nevertheless, in 1105, a ray of hope appeared. Sultan Baki Yaruk had just died of tuberculosis, which put an end to the interminable fratricidal warfare that had paralyzed the Seljuk Empire since the beginning of the Frankish invasion. Henceforth, Iraq, Syria, and western Persia were supposed to have but a single master, the Sultan, savior of the world and of religion, Muhammad ibn Malik Shah. This 24-year-old Seljuk Sultan's title was taken literally by the Tripolitanians. Fakhr al-Mulk sent the Sultan message after message and received endless promises in return, but there was no sign of any rescuing army. In the meantime, the blockade of the city was tightened. Saint-Gilles was replaced by one of his cousins, al-Serdani, the Count of Cerdagne, who stepped up the pressure on the besieged. It was increasingly difficult to get food through overland. The prices of foodstuffs within the city spiraled dizzyingly. A pound of dates was sold for a gold dinar, a coin that would normally suffice to feed an entire family for several weeks. Many citizens sought to emigrate to Tyre, Homs, or Damascus. Hunger led to betrayals. One day, some Tripolitanian notables sought out al-Serdani and, in exchange for his favors, revealed how the city was still managing to receive some provisions. Fakhr al-Mulk then offered his adversary a fabulous sum if he would deliver the traitors, but the count refused. The next morning, the notables were found inside the enemy camp itself. Their throats had been cut. Despite this exploit, the situation in Tripoli continued to deteriorate. There was still no sign of rescue, and persistent rumors suggested the imminent approach of a Frankish fleet. In despair, Fakhr al-Mulk decided to go in person to Baghdad to plead his cause before the Sultan Muhammad and the Caliph al-Mustadzir Billah. In his absence, one of his cousins was entrusted with the interim government of the city, and the troops were given 6 months' pay in advance. A large escort had been prepared, 500 cavalry and foot soldiers, plus many servants bearing gifts of every description, engraved swords, thoroughbred horses, brocaded robes of honor, as well as various products of the goldsmith's craft, Tripoli's speciality. Thus it was that towards the end of March 1108, Fakhr al-Mulk left the city with his long cortege. He left Tripoli by land, reports Ibn al-Kalanisi unambiguously, the only chronicler who actually lived through these events, thus suggesting that the Cadi obtained permission from the Frange to pass through their lines in order to go and preach holy war against them. Given the curious relations between the besiegers and the besieged, that is not impossible. But it seems more plausible that the Cadi reached Beirut by boat and only then took the land route. However that may be, Fakhr al-Mulk stopped first in Damascus. The ruler of Tripoli had a marked aversion for Dukak, but the inept Seljuk king had died some time earlier, probably poisoned, and the city was now in the hands of his tutor, the Atabeg Tughtigan, a lame former slave whose ambiguous relations with the Frange were to dominate the Syrian political scene for more than 20 years. Ambitious, wily, and unscrupulous, this Turkish officer, like Fakhr al-Mulk himself, was a mature and realistic man. In contrast with the vindictive stance adopted by Dukak, Tughtigin received the master of Tripoli warmly, held a great banquet in his honor, and even invited him to his own private bath. The Cadi appreciated these attentions, but preferred to be lodged outside the walls. Confidence has its limits. In Baghdad, his reception was even more sumptuous. So great was Tripoli's prestige in the Muslim world that the Cadi was treated as a powerful monarch. Sultan Muhammad took him across the Tigris in his own boat. The officers of protocol led the master of Tripoli through a floating salon to where had been placed a brocade cushion on which the Sultan usually sat. Fakhr al-Mulk settled himself next to it in the place usually allotted to visitors, But the dignitaries rushed forward and took him by the arm. The monarch had personally insisted that his guest be seated on his own cushion. The Cadi was welcomed in one palace after another and was asked many questions by the Sultan, the Caliph, and their collaborators. He wanted to know everything about the siege, and all Baghdad praised Fakhr al-Mulk's bravery in the jihad against the French. But when it finally came to political matters and Fakhr al-Mulk asked Mohammed to send an army to lift the siege of Tripoli, the Sultan, Ibn al-Kalanisi spitefully reports, ordered several of his principal emirs to go with Fakhr al-Mulk to help repel those who were besieging the city. He instructed the expeditionary force to stop briefly in Mosul to take the city from Jawali and told them to head for Tripoli once that was done. Fakhr al-Mulk was devastated. The situation in Mosul was so muddled that it would take years to sort out. Moreover, the city was situated north of Baghdad, whereas Tripoli lay due west. If the army made such a detour, it would never arrive in time to save his capital, which, he insisted, was liable to collapse any day now. But the Sultan would not hear of it. The interests of the Seljuk Empire required that the problem of Mosul be given priority. The Cadi tried everything, even buying some of the Sultan's counselors at inflated prices. But in vain. The army would go first to Mosul. When Fakhr al-Mulk set out to return to Tripoli after a four-month stay in Baghdad, he left without any ceremony. He was now convinced that he would no longer be able to hold his city. What he did not know was that he had already lost it. He was told the sad news when he arrived in Damascus in August 1108. Demoralized by his long absence, the notables of Tripoli had decided to entrust the city to the ruler of Egypt, who promised to defend it against the Frange. Al-Afdal sent his vassals food, as well as a governor to take charge of the city's affairs. His first mission was to arrest the family of Fakhr al-Mulk and his supporters, to seize his treasury, furniture, and personal property, and to send them all to Egypt by ship. While the vizier was thus persecuting the unfortunate Cadi, the Frange were preparing the final assault on Tripoli. One after the other, their commanders had arrived at the walls of the besieged city. King Baldwin of Jerusalem, their supreme commander, was there. Baldwin of Edessa and Tancred of Antioch, who had been reconciled for the occasion, were both there, as were two counts from the family of Saint-Gilles, who had just arrived from his country with dozens of Genoese vessels. Both coveted Tripoli, but the king of Jerusalem ordered them to halt their quarrels. Ibn Saint-Gilles would await the end of the battle to have his rival assassinated. In March 1709, everything seemed ready for a concerted attack by land and sea. The terrified Tripolitanians observed all these preparations but did not lose hope. Had not Al-Afdal promised to send a fleet more powerful than any they had ever seen, with enough food, fighters, and materiel to hold out for a year? The Tripolitanians had no doubt that the Genoese vessels would flee the moment the Fatimid fleet sailed into view. Let it only arrive in time. At the beginning of the summer, Ibn al-Kalanisi says, the Frange launched an attack on Tripoli with all their forces, driving their mobile towers toward the city walls. When the people of the city saw what violent assaults they would have to face, they lost heart, for they understood that their defeat was inevitable. Food supplies were exhausted, and the Egyptian fleet was nowhere in sight. The winds were blowing against them, for such was the will of God, who determines what things will come to pass. The Frange redoubled their efforts and took the city by storm on the 12th of July, 1709. After 2,000 days of resistance, the city of goldsmiths and libraries, of intrepid seamen and learned Cadis, was sacked by the warriors of the West. 100,000 volumes of the Dar al-Hilm were pillaged and burned so that impious books would be destroyed. According to the chronicler of Damascus, the Frange decided that one-third of the city would go to the Genoese, the other two-thirds to the son of Saint-Gilles. All that King Baldwin desired was set aside for him. Most of the inhabitants were sold into slavery, the rest were despoiled of their property and expelled. Many headed for the port of Tyre. Fakhr al-Mulk ended his life in the vicinity of Damascus. And the Egyptian fleet? It arrived in Tyre 8 days after the fall of Tripoli, Ibn al-Kalanisi relates, when all had been lost because of the divine punishment that had struck the inhabitants. The Frange selected Beirut as their second target. Lying next to the Lebanese mountains, the city was ringed by pine forests, in particular in the suburbs of Mazrat al-Harab and Rat al-Nabash. There the invaders would find the wood they needed to construct the instruments of siege. Beirut had none of the splendor of Tripoli, and its modest villas could not easily be compared to the Roman palaces whose marble ruins were still scattered across the grounds of ancient Berytus. But because of its port, it was a relatively prosperous city, situated on the rocky slope where, according to tradition, St. George had slain the dragon. Coveted by the Damascenes, held negligently by the Egyptians, Beirut finally had to confront the Frange on its own, beginning in February 1110. Its 5,000 inhabitants fought with an ardor born of despair as they destroyed the siege towers one after another. Never before or since did the Frange face such a harsh battle, Ibn al-Kalanisi exclaimed. The invaders were unforgiving. On the 13th of May, when the city was taken, they threw themselves into a blind massacre to set an example. The lesson was well learned. The following summer, a certain Frankish king, the Damascene chronicler may be forgiven for failing to recognize Sigurd, the sovereign of distant Norway, arrived by sea with more than 60 vessels packed with fighters intent on making their pilgrimage and waging war in the lands of Islam. They headed towards Jerusalem, Baldwin joined them, and together they laid siege by land and sea to the port of Saida, the ancient Phoenician city of Sidon. The walls of this city, destroyed and rebuilt more than once in the course of history, are impressive even today, their enormous blocks of stone lashed relentlessly by the Mediterranean. But the inhabitants, who had shown great courage at the beginning of the Frankish invasion, no longer had the heart to fight, since, according to Ibn al-Kalanisi, they feared that they would suffer the same fate as Beirut. They therefore sent their Qadi with a delegation of notables to ask Baldwin to spare their lives. He accepted their request. The city capitulated on the 4th of December, 1110. This time there was no massacre, but a massive exodus to Tyre and Damascus, which were already bulging with refugees. In the space of 18 months, three of the most renowned cities of the Arab world, Tripoli, Beirut, and Saida, had been taken and sacked, their inhabitants massacred or deported, their emirs, cadis, and experts on religious law killed or forced into exile, their mosques profaned. Could any power now prevent the Frange from pressing on to Tyre, Aleppo, Damascus, Cairo, Mosul, or why not, even Baghdad? Did any will to resist remain? Among the Muslim leaders, probably not. But among the population of the most seriously threatened cities, the relentless holy war waged for the past 13 years by the pilgrim fighters of the West was beginning to have its effect. The idea of jihad, which had long been no more than a slogan used to enliven official speeches, was being reasserted. Groups of refugees, poets, and even men of religion were now preaching it anew. It was one of these religious figures, Abdul Fadl ibn al-Kassab, a Qadi of Aleppo, small of stature but loud of voice, who resolved, by sheer tenacity and strength of character, to waken the sleeping giant of the Arab world. His first public initiative was to rekindle, 12 years on, the scandal that al-Harawi had aroused in the streets of Baghdad. This time, however, there would be a genuine riot. Chapter 5. Turban-Clad Resistance. On Friday the 17th of February, 1111, the Qadi Ibn al-Kansab burst in the Sultan's mosque in Baghdad, accompanied by a large group of Aleppans, among them a Hashemite Sharif, a descendant of the Prophet, and a number of Sufi ascetics, imams, and merchants. Ibn al-Kalanisi describes what happened next. They forced the preacher to descend from the pulpit, which they smashed. They then began to cry out, to bewail the evils that had befallen Islam because of the Frange, who were killing men and enslaving women and children. Since they were preventing the faithful from saying their prayers, the officials present made various promises in the name of the Sultan in an effort to pacify them. Armies would be sent to defend Islam against the Frange and all the infidels. But these fine words were not enough to soothe the rebels. The following Friday, they restaged their demonstration, this time in the mosque of the Caliph. When guards tried to bar their way, they quickly thrust them aside, smashed the wooden minbar, which was adorned with carved arabesques and verses of the Koran, and hurled insults at the Prince of the Faithful himself. Baghdad was plunged into the greatest confusion. At the same moment, relates the Damascene chronicler in a disingenuously naive tone, the princess, sister of Sultan Muhammad and wife of the Caliph, arrived in Baghdad from Isfahan with a magnificent retinue. There were precious stones, sumptuous robes, all sorts of saddlery and beasts of burden, servants, slaves of both sexes, attendants, and many other things that would defy estimation and enumeration. Her arrival coincided with the scenes described above. The joy and security of the royal arrival were disrupted. The Caliph al-Mustadzir Billah manifested considerable discontent. He wanted to prosecute those responsible for the incident and to punish them severely. But the Sultan prevented him from doing so, pardoned the actions of these people, and ordered the emirs and military officers to return to their provinces to prepare a jihad against the infidels, the enemies of God. If the worthy al-Mustadzir was thus moved to anger, it was not only because of the disagreeable effects of the turmoil on his young wife, but also because of the terrifying slogan that had been shouted so deafeningly in the streets of the capital. The King of the Room is a better Muslim than the Prince of the Faithful. For he was well aware that this was no gratuitous accusation. The demonstrators led by Ibn al-Kashab were alluding to a message received a few weeks earlier by the Caliph's Diwan. It came from the Emperor Alexius Comnenus and insistently called upon the Muslims to unite with the Room, to struggle against the Frange and expel them from our lands. If the powerful master of Constantinople and the humble Cadi of Aleppo seemed to have made common cause in their initiatives in Baghdad, it was because they both felt that they had been humiliated by the same man, Tancred. When Byzantine ambassadors were sent to remind Tancred that the Knights of the West had promised to restore Antioch to the Basileus, and that 13 years after the fall of the city they had yet to do so, the great emir of the Franks had insolently shown them the door. As for the Aleppans, Tancred had recently imposed a particularly discreditable treaty upon them. They were to pay him an annual tribute of 20,000 dinars, hand over two important fortresses in the immediate vicinity of their city, and give him, as a gift and sign of allegiance, their 10 finest horses. Ridwan, fearful as ever, dared not refuse, but the streets of his capital had been seething ever since the terms of the treaty had been revealed. It had always been the custom in Aleppo for people to gather in small groups to hold lively discussions of the dangers threatening them at critical moments in their history. The notables would get together in the great mosque, sitting cross-legged on the red carpets, sometimes in the courtyard in the shade of the minaret that overlooked the ochre-colored houses of the city. The merchants would meet during the day along the old colonnaded avenue built by the Romans, which ran across Aleppo from west to east, from the gate of Antioch to the forbidden quarter of the citadel, where the sullen Ridwan resided. This major artery had long been closed to wagons and processions. The roadway had been taken over by hundreds of little booths in which cloth, amber, trinkets, dates, pistachio nuts, and condiments were amassed. The avenue and its neighboring alleyways were covered with a wooden ceiling to protect passers-by from sun and rain. At the intersections, it rose up into high stucco domes. At the corners of the alleys, especially those leading to the souks of the makers of straw mats, the blacksmiths and the sellers of wood for heating, the Aleppans would gossip before the many low-class eating houses. Amidst a persistent odor of boiling oil, grilled meat, and spices, these places offered meals at moderate prices, chunks of grilled mutton, doughnuts, lentils. Families of modest means would buy their food ready-made in the souks. Only the rich cooked at home. Not far from the food stalls, the characteristic tinkle of the sharab sellers could be heard. These cold drinks of concentrated fruit, the Frange would later borrow from the Arabs in liquid and frozen forms, calling them sirops and sorbets. In the afternoon, people of all walks of life would meet in the hammam, or public bath, that special meeting place where one cleansed oneself before the sunset prayer. As night fell, the citizens would desert the center of Aleppo to return to their own quarters, away from drunken soldiers. There, too, news and rumors would circulate, passed on by men and women alike, and ideas would wend their way through the city. Anger, enthusiasm, discouragement would daily stir this hive, which had buzzed in just this way for more than 3 millennia. Ibn al-Kashab was the most respected man in the quarters of Aleppo. Born of a family of rich wood merchants, he played a primordial role in the administration of the city. As a Shi'i Qadi, he enjoyed great religious and moral authority. He was responsible for resolving disputes involving the people and property of his community, the largest in Aleppo. In addition, he was a Ra'is, or chief of the city, which made him simultaneously provost of the merchants, representative of the interests of the population before the king, and commandant of the urban militia. But Ibn al-Kashab's activities went beyond the already wide competence of his official functions. Ever since the arrival of the Franj, he had, through his numerous coterie, encouraged a patriotic and pietistic current of public opinion that demanded a firmer attitude against the invaders. He was not afraid to tell King Ridwan what he thought of his conciliatory, even servile, policy. When Tancred obliged the Seljuk monarch to affix a cross to the minaret of the great mosque, the Cadi organized a riot and had the crucifix transferred to the St. Helene Cathedral. Since then, Ridwan had avoided any conflict with the irascible Cadi. Entrenched in the citadel with his harem and bodyguard, with his own mosque, his own source of water, and his grassy racecourse, the Turkish king preferred to spare the sensibilities of his subjects. So long as his own authority was not challenged, he tolerated public opinion. In 1111, however, Ibn al-Kassab turned up at the citadel to tell Ridwan once again of the citizens' extreme discontent. The faithful, he explained, were scandalized at having to pay tribute to infidels implanted in the land of Islam, and the merchants' businesses had been in peril ever since the intolerable Prince of Antioch had seized control of all the routes from Aleppo to the Mediterranean, where he was holding caravans to ransom. Since the city could no longer defend itself with its own resources, the Cadi proposed that a delegation of Sunni and Shi'i notables, merchants and men of religion, be sent to Baghdad to seek the aid of Sultan Mohammed. Ridwan had no desire to involve his Seljuk cousin in the affairs of his kingdom. He still preferred to deal with Tancred. But in view of the futility of all missions hitherto dispatched to the Abbasid capital, he felt that the least risky course of action would be to accede to his subjects' request. In this he was mistaken. Against all expectations, the Baghdad demonstrations of February 1111 produced just the effect sought by Ibn al-Kashab. The Sultan, who had just been informed of the fall of Saider and the treaty imposed on the Aleppans, felt growing unease at the ambitions of the Franj. Yielding to Ibn al-Kassab's entreaties, he ordered the latest in the line of governors of Mosul, the Emir Mordud, to march without delay at the head of a powerful army and to rescue Aleppo. When Ibn al-Kassab returned to Aleppo and informed Ridwan of the success of his mission, the king pretended to rejoice while praying that nothing would come of it. He even informed his cousin of his eagerness to participate in the jihad at his side. But in July, when he was told that the Sultan's troops were actually approaching the city, he could no longer conceal his consternation. He ordered the gates of the city to be barricaded, arrested Ibn al-Kassab and his major supporters, and imprisoned them in the citadel. The Turkish soldiers were ordered to patrol the residential quarters day and night to prevent any contact between the populace and the enemy. The sequel of events was to justify Ridwan's volte-face, at least in part. Deprived of supplies the king was supposed to procure for them, the Sultan's troops took their revenge by savagely plundering the environs of Aleppo. Then, following dissension between Mordud and the other emirs, the army disintegrated without fighting a single battle. Mordud returned to Syria 2 years later under orders from the Sultan to assemble all the Muslim princes, except Ridwan, against the Franj. Since Aleppo was off limits to him, he quite naturally established his general headquarters in Damascus, that other great city, in preparation for a large-scale offensive against the Kingdom of Jerusalem. His host, the Atabeg Tughtigin, pretended to be thrilled by the honor that the Sultan's envoy had thus bestowed upon him, but in fact he was as terrified as Ridwan had been. He feared that Mordud sought only to take over his capital, and resented the emir's every deed as a threat to his own future. On the 2nd of October, 1113, the Damascene chronicler tells us, the emir Mordud left his camp, situated near the Gate of Iron, one of the eight entrances to the city. He walked, as he did every day, to the Umayyad Mosque, in the company of the lame Atabeg. When the prayer was over and Mordud had performed several supplementary devotions, they both departed, Tutigin walking ahead out of respect for the emir. They were surrounded by soldiers, guards, and militiamen bearing arms of all varieties, the slender sabers, sharp epees, scimitars, and unsheathed daggers gave an impression of thick undergrowth. All around them, crowds pressed forward to admire their arsenal and their magnificence. When they reached the courtyard of the mosque, a man emerged from the crowd and approached the emir Mordud as if to pray God on his behalf and to ask alms of him. Suddenly, he seized the belt of his mantle and struck him twice with his dagger just above the navel. The Atabeg Tuhtigin took a few steps backwards, and his companions quickly surrounded him. As for Mordud, who never lost his head, he walked as far as the north gate of the mosque and then collapsed. A surgeon was summoned and managed to suture some of the wounds, but the emir died several hours later. May God have mercy upon him. Who killed the governor of Mosul on the very eve of his offensive against the Frange? Tuhtigin lost no time in accusing Ridwan and his friends of the assassin's sect. But most contemporaries believe that no one but the master of Damascus himself could have armed the killer. According to Ibn al-Athir, King Baldwin was so shocked by the murder that he sent Tuhtigin a particularly contemptuous message. A nation that kills its leader in the house of its god deserves to be annihilated. As for Sultan Muhammad, he howled with rage when he learned of the death of his lieutenant. He considered the heinous crime a personal insult, and he decided to bring all the Syrian leaders into line once and for all, those of Aleppo as well as those of Damascus. He raised an army of several tens of thousands of soldiers, commanded by the best officers of the Seljuk clan, and curtly ordered all the Muslim princes to join it in its sacred duty of waging jihad against the Frange. When the Sultan's powerful expedition arrived in central Syria in the spring of 1115, a great surprise awaited it. This book is continued at this point, on the other side of this cassette.